Good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas, gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today is March 29th, the 88th day of the year. 277 days remain to the year's over with. Holidays and observances. National Smoke and Mirrors Day. It's like going to Congress. You step into a world of illusion where reality is questioned. The impossible becomes possible. It amazes and mystifies. It's Good Friday. International Mermaid Day. World Piano Day. Get all keyed up for that one. National Lemon Chiffon Cake Day. Niagara Falls Runs Dry Day. You know, it has run dry once or twice in the past. Payday at Farwood, Tick Bite Prevention Week, National Physicians Week, March Madness, we're still in Ramadan until April the 8th, National Cleaning Week. March is also the Great Daffodil Appeal Month, National Reading Month, National Sauce Month, Veggie Month, National Peanut Month, National Colon Cancer Awareness Month, Epilepsy Awareness Month, Developmental Disability Awareness Month, Brain Tumor Awareness Month, National Women's History Month, National Hemophilia Awareness Month, National Nutrition Month, National Social Work Month, National Small Press Month, Multiple Sclerosis Awareness Month, National Caffeine Awareness Month, National Umbrella Month, National Kidney Month, National Craft Month, International Ideas Month, National Credit Education Month, National Cheerleading Safety Month, Rising Star Month, Endometriosis Awareness Month, National Music in Our Schools Month, Irish American History Month, and National Athletic Training Month. Alrighty. Well, in 1430, the Ottoman Empire under Murad II captured Thessalonica from the Republic of Venice. 1461, the Battle of Towton. Edward of York defeats Queen Margaret to become King Edward IV of England, bringing a temporary stop to the Wars of the Roses. Edward IV is one of my ancestors. Of course, we didn't get any of the money. 1549, the city of Salvador Bahia, the first capital of Brazil, is founded. 1632, Treaty of Saint Germain is signed, returning Quebec to French control after the English had seized it in 1629. 1792, King Gustav III of Sweden dies after being shot in the back at a midnight masquerade ball at the Stockholm's Royal Opera 13 days before. 1806, construction is authorized to the Great National Pike, better known as the Cumberland Road, becoming the first United States federal highway. 1809, King Gustav IV Adolf of Sweden abdicates after a coup d'etat. 1809, at the Diet of Porvoo, Finland's four estates pledge allegiance to Alexander I of Russia, commencing the succession of the Grand Duchy of Finland from Sweden. 1847, Mexican-American War. U.S. forces led by General Winfield Scott take Veracruz after a siege. 1849, the U.K. annexes the Punjab. 1857, Sepoy Mangal Pandey of the 34th Regiment, Bengal Native Infantry mutinies against the East India Company's rule in India and inspires the protracted Indian Rebellion of 1857, which was also known as the Sepoy Mutiny. 1867, Queen Victoria gives royal assent to the British North America Act, which establishes Canada on July 1st. 1871, Royal Albert Hall is opened by Queen Victoria. 1879, the Anglo-Zulu War, Battle of Kambula. British forces defeat 20,000 Zulus. 1882, the Knights of Columbus is established. 1927, Sunbeam, 1,000 horsepower, breaks the land speed record at Daytona Beach, Florida. 1936, German parliamentary election and referendum seeks approval for the recent remilitarization of the Rhineland. 1941, North American Regional Broadcasting Agreement goes into effect at 3 o'clock local time. That's 3 in the morning, don't you know? Also in 1941, World War II, British Royal Navy and Royal Australian Navy forces defeat those of the Italian Regia Marina off the Peloponnesian coast of Greece in the Battle of Cape Matapan. 1942, the bombing of Lubeck in World War II is the first major success for the RAF Bomber Command against Germany in a German city. 1947, Malagasy Uprising against French colonial rule begins in Madagascar. 1951, Julius Nethel Rosenberger convicted of conspiracy to commit espionage. 1951, hypnosis murders take place in Copenhagen. The Copenhagen hypnosis murders were a double murder case in conjunction with a failed bank robbery that happened in Denmark on March 29th, 1951. After an extensive police, psychiatric, and psychological investigations and the ensuing trial proceedings, two people were convicted of the murders, Polly Hardrup and Bjorn Sworn Nielsen. It was the view of the trial court in a decision the Danish Supreme Court affirmed that Sworn Nielsen had hypnotized the 28-year-old Hardrup to carry out the robbery and the murders. Both men served prison sentences and were released in 1967. Nielsen died by suicide in 1971. Hardrup lived until 2012. When Hardrup committed the robbery, he shot one of the bank's cashiers and then the branch manager. Then he fled by bicycle. Well, that's a getaway car, don't you know? To a nearby street and entered a building. Several eyewitnesses chased and went in after him, and the police were directed to a stairwell where he tried to hide. He surrendered to the police without any resistance. The bicycle that was actually used by Hardrup in his escape belonged to Bjorn Sworn Nielsen. A few days after the incident, Nielsen himself contacted the police and claimed he wanted to make sure he wasn't a robbery suspect just because Hardrup had used his bicycle. Well, give the police an idea and they're going to follow up on it. 1957, New York, Ontario, and Western Railway makes its final run. First major U.S. railroad to be abandoned in its entirety. Okay. Also on this date, 1961, the 23rd Amendment to the U.S. Constitution is ratified. That allows residents of Washington, D.C. to vote in presidential elections. 1962, Arturo Frondizi, president of Argentina, is overthrown in a military coup by Argentina's armed forces. Ended an 11-and-a-half-day constitutional crisis. 1971, the My Lai Massacre. Lieutenant William Calley is convicted of premeditated murder and sentenced to life in prison. He was eventually released. Married the daughter of a wealthy family in Columbus, Georgia, and wound up being a manager of a jewelry store. I met him a couple of times. 1973, Vietnam War. Last U.S. combat soldiers leave South Vietnam. Also in 73, Operation Barrel Roll, covert American bombing campaign in Laos to stop communist infiltration of South Vietnam ends on this date. They were trying to keep the Viet Cong from using the Ho Chi Minh Trail. 1974, NASA's Mariner 10 becomes the first space probe to fly by Mercury. Now, also in 1974, the Terracotta Army is discovered in Shanxi Province in China. 1982, the Canada Act of 1982 receives royal assent from Queen Elizabeth II, sets a stage for the Queen of Canada to proclaim the Constitution Act of 1982. 1984, the Baltimore Colts load its possessions into 15 Mayflower moving trucks in the early morning hours and transfer its operation to Indianapolis. A sad day for football. 1990, Czechoslovak parliament is unable to reach an agreement on what to call the country after the fall of communism, sparking the so-called hyphen war. 1999, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closes above the 10,000 mark. Actually, it was 10,006.78 for the first time during the height of the dot-com bubble. 1999, magnitude 6.8 earthquake in India strikes the Chamoli district in Uttar Pradesh, kills 103. 2001, a Gulfstream 3 crashes on approach to Aspen-Pitkin County Airport in Aspen, Colorado. All 18 people on board are killed. 2002, in reaction to the Passover massacre 2 days before, Israel launches Operation Defensive Shield against Palestinian militants. It's the largest military operation in the West Bank since the 1967 Six-Day War. Now, for those that don't remember the Passover massacre, it was a suicide bombing carried out by Hamas at the Park Hotel in Netanya, Israel, on March 27, 2002, during a Passover Seder. 30 civilians were killed in the attack, 140 were injured. Deadliest attack against Israeli civilians during the Second Intifada. 2004, Bulgaria, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia joined NATO as full members on this date. 2010, two suicide bombers hit the Moscow metro system at the peak of the morning rush hour, killed 40 people. 2013, at least 36 people were killed when a 16-floor building collapses in the commercial capital Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. 2014, the first same-sex marriage in England and Wales are performed. 2015, Air Canada Flight 624 skids off the runway at Halifax Stanfield International Airport after arriving from Toronto shortly past midnight. All 133 passengers and 5 crews on board survived, with 23 treated for minor injuries. 2016, a U.S. Air Force F-16 crashes during takeoff from the Bagram Airfield in Afghanistan. And in 2017, Prime Minister Theresa May invokes Article 50 of the Treaty on European Union, formally beginning the United Kingdom's withdrawal from the European Union. They just really were not happy with being a member of what was basically the United States of Europe. Well, we're going to do one more day of unsolved mysteries. Murder mysteries, that is. And next week we'll have a new bizarre topic. Let's talk about the Lake Bodum murders of 1960. It was a seemingly motiveless attack on 4 sleeping teenagers in a famous Finnish beauty spot. And it's never even been a suggestion of who might have carried it out or why. It these motiveless murders are just absolutely bizarre. And also keep in mind, when police investigate, they investigate each one separately. So if you've got a serial killer running around, it's going to take them a while to catch on. Well, Finland's beautiful Lake Bodom is situated near the southern city of Espoo. Between June and August, the sun doesn't set, temperatures soar, and Finns of all ages flock to the lake to celebrate the arrival of summer and the passing of the long freezing winter. And it was in the spirit of enjoying the arrival of summer on June 4th, 1960, that 4 teenagers pitched their tent on the lake shore. Maila, Ermela, Bajorkan, Anha, Tuliki Maki, both 15, and her two boyfriends, Sipo and Tero Boisman and Nils Wilhelm Gustafsson, both 18, planned on evening of fishing and camping. After riding their motorcycles to Lake Bodom from their hometown of Vanta, the teenagers chose a spot shaded by birch trees along the idyllic Finnish bay. Spent the evening chatting and swimming and fishing and completely oblivious to what was going to happen at their campsite. Between 4 in the morning and 6 in the morning, on the morning of June 5th, the sleeping teenagers were all brutally attacked. They were bludgeoned with a heavy object, possibly a large rock, slashed and stabbed with a knife. The murder weapons had never been found. At 11 in the morning, a local carpenter named Risto Sorin stumbled across the scene while out for a swim with his son. Miraculously, Nils Gustafsson was unconscious but still alive. He was the sole survivor of the brutal attack, but he didn't survive without injuries. He got a concussion, fractures to the jaw, bruises on his face, stab wounds. When he came to, he said he had no recollection of the attack due to shock. He said, "My last memory is when we went to bed and wished each other good night. After that, I don't remember if it was Wednesday or Thursday when I woke up." His girlfriend, Maila, sustained the most vicious injuries. She was discovered lying on top of the tent with her underwear removed, and she'd suffered significant more stab wounds than the others. A cluster of wounds had been inflicted post-mortem, majority on her neck. So you got somebody who wasn't totally well-wrapped who carried out these killings. Investigation concluded the killer hadn't entered the tent, but had attacked the teenagers from outside it as they slept. The tent itself had at least 25 slashes, and several items belonging to the teenagers appear to have been stolen, including a wallet and items of clothing, including Neil's shoes. Strangely, the keys to the victim's motorcycles had been taken, but the bikes themselves were not. About 874 yards from the crime scene, several of the items were found, including Neil's shoes, which were partially hidden. In front of the mangled tent was a set of bloody footprints and matched Neil's discarded shoes, implying the killer had fled the scene while wearing the boy's shoes. Now, two boys that had been burn watching near the crime scene came forward to tell the police they had seen a black-haired man walk away from the collapsed tent at about 6 in the morning. These eyewitnesses would later undergo hypnosis in the hope they could provide more information. And while they couldn't give any further details, their story didn't change, and a composite sketch of this unidentified man was drawn by a police sketch artist. After making a full recovery from his injuries, Nils would also undergo hypnosis. During his session, he recollected a vision of a figure coming toward him, clad in black and with glaring red eyes. Over time, several individuals became suspects in the gruesome triple murders. One of the most plausible was Carl Valdemar Gilstrom, kiosk vendor at Lake Bodum, known locally for his aggressive behavior toward campers. On occasion, he had even slashed the ropes of tents, causing them to collapse on the sleeping occupants. Ulf Johansson, author of the 2016 book on the case called The Legend of Bodum, recalled how he was once a victim of Carl's angry outburst. When Ulf was a teenager, Carl had thrown rocks at him as he cycled past. Sounds like somebody has got a bit of a problem. Local people found it suspicious following the murders. Carl had filled in a well on his property. And because the murder weapon had never been discovered, some suspected they'd been dropped into the well before it was filled in. Well, in 1969, Carl drowned in Lake Bodum. Before his death, he allegedly confessed to a neighbor he'd killed the campers. He had never been fully investigated as a suspect in the murders. His wife had provided a seemingly ironclad alibi for him, claiming he was in bed asleep. However, shortly before she passed away, she confessed that this alibi was false and said he'd threatened to kill her and her children if she refused to provide a cover story for him. Well, another prime suspect throughout the investigation was an alleged KGB spy named Hans Osman, who once claimed, bizarrely, he'd served as a guard at Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland during World War II. The day after the murders, Hans checked himself into the Helsinki Surgical Hospital, and his appearance was described as somewhat disheveled. Nurses recollected his fingernails were black with dirt and his clothing was stained with a red substance. The doctors that saw him that afternoon were adamant the red stains on his clothes were blood. And he was said to have acted in a suspicious manner at the hospital, giving a false name, telling contradictory stories about how he'd injured himself, and even feigning unconsciousness. However, despite the doctors' and nurses' reports, his blood-stained clothes were never examined by police. Another case of, we know who did it, and we don't care about anything else. Well, after the description of the blonde-haired suspect spotted by the young bird watchers was released to the media, and I thought I had written earlier that it was a blonde-haired man, not black. I can't even read this today. After the description of the blonde-haired suspect seen by the boat watchers released in the media, Hans actually cut off his blonde hair. In addition, his clothing was said to match that worn by the elusive blonde-haired man, and a man resembling Hans was photographed at the funeral of the victims. And it is not unheard of for killers to make an appearance at their victims' funerals, maybe out of morbid curiosity or with the intention of taunting investigators. Some murderers derive sadistic pleasure from knowing something that nobody else does. But despite all this strong, admittedly circumstantial evidence, Hines was never even brought in for questioning. Well, several books have been written about Hines Osmond, and he's been linked to other unsolved murders, including that of 17-year-old Ali Kuliki Sari in May of 1953. She was murdered while cycling home from a prayer meeting. 2003, Dr. Jormo Paolo had been training at the Helsinki Surgical Hospital, and Hines came in for treatment and published a book in which he named Hines as the killer. Allegedly, while on his deathbed, Hines confessed to the murders, but unfortunately, this claim can't be verified. Well, the case eventually went cold, but because Finland has no statute of limitations for murder, it was reopened in 2004. Sole survivor Nils Gustafsson, now married with two grown-up children, was arrested on suspicion of having committed the murders. Investigators claimed the broken jaw he sustained during the attack was the result of a fight with Sipo Boisman, his best friend. And I believe Nils had killed the trio and arranged the murder scene, inflicting the knife wounds and blunt force trauma on himself to give the impression of a frenzied attack by an unknown killer. And investigators announced they had discovered a key piece of evidence that allegedly tied Nils to the murders. DNA testing had been carried out on Gustafsson's discarded shoes, revealed traces of the victim's blood. Well, Nils Gustafsson's trial began August 4, 2005. Defense argued new DNA evidence didn't prove that Nils was guilty of the murders. They said the killer could easily have stolen Nils' shoes along with several other items of clothing that were taken. Prosecution refuted these arguments, stating that Gustafsson had committed the murders and then discarded his shoes in an attempt to conceal his guilt. Well, keep in mind that prosecutors will say anything to get a conviction. They don't really care that much about justice. They care about proving that they're smarter than the defense counsel. Defense used DNA evidence of their own to strengthen their case by presenting a pillowcase that had been found inside a teenager's tent. On it, they found sperm that didn't match either Gustafsson or Sipo Boisman. They argued this was evidence somebody else had carried out the attack on the victims in a sexual frenzy. And the fact that Gustafsson's own blood was found inside the tent indicated he was also had been inside the tent during the frenzied attack, further strengthening their case. Both the defense and the prosecution produced experts that gave conflicting statements with regard to the injuries that Gustafsson had suffered on that night. Neurology specialist Ali Tenovuo claimed it was very plausible Gustafsson had suffered memory loss following the attack. Prosecution called in the respected physician Eero Hirvensalo, who told the courts he believed Niles' injuries were consistent with being punched with a fist as opposed to being bludgeoned with a heavy object. He said these jaw fractures or low-energy injuries didn't require great violence. Prosecution argued that such injuries weren't serious enough to cause memory loss. Well, see how you'd like to be on the receiving end of those injuries. Ultimately, the court agreed with the defense, accepting the boy's eyewitness testimony of a blonde-haired man departing the scene was credible. It also ruled that an unknown assailant had probably attacked the four teenagers as they slept in their tent and rejected the prosecution scenario a fight between Gustafsson and Boisman had triggered the murders. Court deduced it's very unlikely Gustafsson would have inflicted his wounds on himself. Gustafsson's lawyer, Ritti Lapanimi, made the comment he is very badly injured and couldn't have done what he was charged with. Furthermore, the court questioned how Gustafsson could have disposed of the murder weapon in such a short period of time. Well, after more than 500 days in custody, Gustafsson was acquitted with all charges and awarded what amounted to $49,936 in compensation for the suffering his arrest and trial and the problems that they had caused him. The Lyckbotta murders have haunted Finland for decades, inspiring books and conspiracy theories, movies, even a death metal band named Children of Bodom. Mystery surrounding the identity of the killer or killers, as well as the killer's motive, has elevated the case to quasi-mythical status. Three generations of children have grown up being told not to stay out late for fear of meeting the Bodom murderer. And as long as the murderers or murderers is unidentified, that fear will remain. You know, part of the problem is the initial investigation, if it's not handled properly, will make it almost impossible to solve the case. A prime example of that is the Sam Shepard murder case that I talked about yesterday. I've resurrected the monograph I wrote, 50 years ago? And I'm going to come out with a book detailing everything I discovered. Basically, it was Sam Shepard was railroaded by a lot of people who didn't like the fact that he was a successful doctor and envied him what he had achieved. In a case like the Lake Bodum murders, if there's no previous connection between the victim and the killers, it's very, very difficult to solve a case like that. Another prime example are the Zodiac murders, which took place in 1968 and 69. The Zodiac was a callous killer, acting at random. He was roaming Northern California. And he taunted police by mailing clues to the press in a weird code of his own devising. One Vallejo police detective named Terry Poyser said, "It really comes down to DNA. If you don't have that, you don't have anything." And it's the way things were done, it was very difficult to get DNA. The story began in Benicia, California. A teenage couple on their first date parked on Lake Herman Road in a secluded lover's lane. They were startled by a beam of light. As people are wont to do when surprised like that, they squinted and saw a man frankly, who wouldn't be? I mean, their fears were rooted in their parents finding out they'd been caught in such an intimate setting. Then the stranger pulled out a gun. Then second, 17-year-old David Faraday was fatally shot in the head, and 16-year-old Betty Lou Jensen tried to run and staggered only a little way before collapsing to the ground. She had been shot in the back 5 times. Well, as horrific as the scene was to the sheriff's deputies that began to investigate it December 20th, 1968, they were ignorant of its significance. They immediately assumed the killer had to be a jealous suitor of Betty Lou's. It'd be 7 months before they had learned that this double shooting marked the first murders that would be claimed by a criminal known as the Zodiac Killer. Well, most murderers avoid direct contact with the police, but the Zodiac was different. He chose to deliberately taunt them. He started out by sending 3 letters to California newspapers, the San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, and the Vallejo Times-Herald. Writing those letters claimed responsibility not just for the Benicia shooting, but for another. Darlene Farron was a 22-year-old wife and mother who worked as a waitress at Terry's Waffle Shop in Vallejo, California. June 5, 1969, she picked up her friend, 19-year-old Michael McGowan, and parked in a secluded spot at Blue Rock Springs Park. Clearly, though she may have been a wife, she was not, shall we say, monogamous. A stranger approached with a flashlight, stuck an automatic pistol through the open driver's side window, and opened fire. Farron was killed, but despite being shot in the jaw, the hip, the leg, and the shoulder, McGowan survived. Though his physical recovery would take several months. Recalling the attack, he told police when he cried out in pain, the killer returned to fire 2 more shots at him and his companion before leaving him for dead. In his letters, the Zodiac not only claimed credit for the murders, but he also revealed specific details only the shooter and the investigating officers could know. For example, they stated that David was lying on his back with his feet facing toward the car. Betty Lou was lying on her right side, and Darlene was wearing patterned trousers. And the letters also correctly identified Super X as the brand of ammunition used in the Benicia killing, and Western as the ammunition employed in the Vallejo murder. Well, split among the 3 letters was a cipher that the writer claimed would identify him. He demanded the newspapers run the cipher in full. He said if they didn't, he'd go on a killing spree. So within days, the newspapers complied. The code was a mishmash of English and Greek letters, as well as symbols from astrology, the Egyptian Book of the Dead, Asian mythology, and from Native American rock carvings. Making it even harder to decipher were misspellings and grammatical errors. Nevertheless, within a week, a high school teacher named Donald Hardin had cracked the code, working with his wife. According to what he revealed, "I like killing people because it's more fun than killing wild game in the forest, because man is the most dangerous animal of all. To kill something gives me the most thrilling experience. Best part is that when I die, I'll be reborn in paradise, and all those I've killed will be my slaves. I'll not give you my name because you'll try to slow down or stop my collecting of slaves from our afterlife. The last 18 letters of that message is still a mystery. Some believe the letters are a coded anagram of the killer's name. And if the killer wanted infamy, his cipher failed to deliver it in full. Psychiatrists went on TV and the newspapers to offer their analysis, which included terms and phrases like omnipotence and delusions of grandeur. One unnamed psychiatrist told the LA Times the killer was most likely an isolated individual, and if the letters and cipher had been faked, it would have been done by a very, very disturbed person. The writings are real. He's probably going to kill again. Well, let's go to Saturday, September 27th, a warm and sunny day. Perfect day for Cecilia Ann Shepherd, 22, and Brian Hartnell, 20, to have a picnic. They dated during college, but moved on to become friends. Lake Berryessa Park, about 20 miles north of Napa, California, offered a picturesque scene for their evening outing as they spread out their blanket and food at a spot near the water. Well, at about 6:30 that evening, a car pulled up behind Brian Hartnell's white VW, and a man got out. He was described as at least 6 feet tall, wore dark gloves over his head, a dark blue hood with large slits for his eyes and mouth. And an image was painted on the hood, a cross circle hand-painted in white. Man waved a pistol at the young couple and said he'd escaped from a prison in Montana after killing a guard. Said he only wanted their money and their car keys so he could flee to Mexico. Well, the couple agreed, but the man insisted on tying him up to prevent him from alerting others after he left. So he used a plastic clothesline to tie their hands behind their back and then between their legs, and then he said he had to stab them. Brian Hartnell said, "Stab me first. I'm chicken. I can't stand to see her stabbed." So the masked man responded, "I'll do just that." Once Brian passed out from a dozen knife wounds to his back, the killer sliced Cecilia Ann as though he was frenzied, first in the back and flipped her over to stab her in the breast and the stomach and the groin. The wounds on her front created an outline like the one painted on the hood, crosshairs of a gun sight. Then he left a message, scrawled onto the door of Brian's car with the words, dates, and time. Each related to his attacks on David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen and Darlene Farron and Michael McGow. Vallejo, 12/20/68, 7/4/69, September 27th, 69, 6:30, by knife. Well, the bottom line is the killer wanted credit for his attacks. An hour after the attack, he used a payphone outside of a car wash in Napa to call the police and report his own crime. He said, "I want to report a murder." "No, a double murder. They're 2 miles north of park headquarters. They were in a white Volkswagen Carmen Ghia, and I'm the one that did it." Well, despite their wounds, Brian and Cecilia managed to untie each other. Brian attempted to find help and lost too much blood to get far. Fishman heard Cecilia and Brian's screams and alerted park rangers. Cecilia later died of her wounds, but Brian survived the attack. 2 weeks later, the same man killed a cab driver named Paul Stein in San Francisco. Police likely would have suspected the serial killer slaughtered young couples and also behind the killings of a lone 29-year-old man, but the Zodiac killer himself ensured they knew exactly who the culprit was. He'd torn a piece of bloodied shirt from Stein's lifeless body, and 2 days after the slayings, mailed it to the San Francisco Chronicle. By now, the killer had left behind a scattering of clues. Lake Berryessa, the police found a size 11 footprint with unusual sole pattern. They identified that brand has been sold at Sears. Investigators pulled fingerprints from the payphone in Napa and Stein's taxicab. Unfortunately, Their biggest break also led to their biggest blunder. Three people witnessed Stein's murder and called police, providing a description of the killer. White male, 25 to 30 years old, 5'9", with a stocky build, hair styled in a crew cut, and wearing heavy-rimmed glasses. Somehow, that information was miscommunicated, and officers were told to be on the lookout for a black man. So when two police officers spotted a white man matching that description walking away from the scene, they didn't have any reason to stop him. They later worked with a sketch artist to create a drawing of the man they'd seen, and sketch prompted tips to pour in from the public, but none led to an arrest, unfortunately. Zodiac Killer kept taunting investigators in his letters, boasting to the police they'd never catch him because he was too smart for him. He also threatened school children, promising to shoot out the tire of a school bus and pick off the kiddies as they come bouncing out. You know, this terrifying threat prompted officers throughout the area to guard school buses while volunteer teachers and parents rode inside the vehicles. Now, what they could have done was against somebody shooting, it was anybody's guess, but doing something's better than doing nothing, I guess. At the height of the Zodiac panic, a man identifying himself as the killer called into a TV show hosted by Jim Dunbar of KGO-TV in the San Francisco Bay Area. Caller insisted he speak on the air with famed attorney Melvin Belli. Belli, of course, is best known for representing Jack Ruby, the man that killed Lee Harvey Oswald, the alleged assassin of President Kennedy. Over the course of 2 hours, more than a dozen phone calls, the killer said he was sick and suffered from headaches until they alleviated the pain. Well, Belli tried to coax him into surrendering to police, and at times the caller seemed receptive, but then blurted, I don't want to give myself up, I want to kill those kids. Well, interestingly enough, this entire exchange was televised. Police were never able to confirm whether the caller was the killer or a hoaxer, but it did fascinate the viewing public. Well, Stein is the last of the 7 confirmed Zodiac victims, 5 fatalities and 2 severely injured, but others are suspected. Paul Avery, a veteran crime reporter at the Chronicle, wrote in 1970 the same killer may have been at work in 1966 as well. Avery reported that notes similar to the ones from the Zodiac Killer were sent to the Riverside Press Enterprise and to police after the 1966 slaying of 18-year-old Sherry Jo Bates. She'd been lured from her stall car into a deserted parking lot where she'd been stabbed to death. Notes sent afterwards said Bates had to die and there's going to be more. And the 2 notes were signed with a Z, allegedly standing for Zodiac. Well, Paula Avery also connected the Zodiac killer to the kidnapping of a 23-year-old mother, Kathleen Johns, who was driving with her 1-year-old daughter from San Bernardino to the San Francisco area when another car flashed its lights at her, prompting her to pull over. Man approached and warned her that one of her car wheels was wobbling and fixed it for her. Now, she started driving again, only to have that same tire completely come off the car. Well, the man that had helped her the first time stopped and offered to take her to a gas station. She agreed, but got a sinking feeling when the man passed one station after another. When she questioned him, he said very calmly he planned to kill her. Well, she managed to get out of the car with her daughter and hide in a ditch. When she finally got to a police station to report the incident, she spotted a wanted poster showing a picture of the Zodiac, and she said, "Oh my God, that's him." Another suspected but unconfirmed Zodiac case centered on 25-year-old Donna Lass, who disappeared from South Lake Tahoe in September 1970. Her body was never found. 6 months later, Avery got a postcard he believed was from the Zodiac killer. Message consisted of cut and pasted newspaper clippings and seemed to say that the Lass's body would be found around in the snow. Note was signed with the cross and circle symbol of the Zodiac's past letters. Some folks thought it was a copycat, especially because it came on the heels of another confirmed and well-publicized Zodiac communique sent to Avery at the Chronicle. Newspapers across the country ran stories about Avery getting a ghoulish Halloween card in late October 1970. Written neatly in white ink was the message, "Peekaboo, you're doomed." And it was signed from your secret pal. Card was adorned with images of skeletons, as well as a handwritten reference to paradise and slaves, and the phrase, "by fire, by gun, and by rope." Well, the card was authenticated by a handwriting expert who had studied the Zodiac Killer's earlier messages. Police thought it was a threat on Avery's life, but he declined to get police protection. He said, I'm not really scared. I needled him in some of my stories, and maybe that's why he wrote to me. He did add, I think I'll be a little more careful for a while. In the last of his 18 confirmed letters, several supposed Zodiac letters have been deemed fakes, the killer praised the classic 1974 horror movie The Exorcist as the best satirical comedy he'd ever seen, claimed his body count had reached 37. After this revelation, the Zodiac seemed to vanish. Well, the end of the Zodiac's killing spree only fueled his mystique. Theories about the killer's true identity are never-ending. Many have stepped forward and claimed to have solved the mystery. Robert Graysmith, a cartoonist working at the Chronicle when the Zodiac Killer announced himself, became obsessed with the case. He wrote two best-selling books that suggested the killer was Arthur Lee Allen. Allen, who died in 1992, had been less than honorably discharged from the Navy in 1958 and fired from a teaching job for molesting a student, also in 68. He wore a Zodiac brand watch, the logo of which was similar to the crosshair signature the killer used. It was reported to the police by a former friend, Don Cheney, who had broken off with Allen when Allen supposedly floated ideas for a novel he planned to write and began talking about calling himself Zodiac and killing people. Well, one of Allen's ideas involved shooting the tower off a school bus and killing the children inside. That was a threat that the Zodiac Killer would subsequently make. In 1974, the same year that the final Zodiac letter was sent, Allen was arrested for molesting a 12-year-old boy. He pled guilty to charge and served a 2-year prison sentence. In 1991, he was identified in a photo lineup by Michael McGowan, one of the Zodiac Killer survivors, but despite a wealth of circumstantial evidence, DNA, fingerprint, and handwriting tests cleared Allen. He died in 1992 in Vallejo, California, of a heart attack. In 2007, when Zodiac, a film adaptation of Graysmith's book, directed by David Fincher, hit cinema and interest was renewed in the case, Detective George Bewert said he was 95% sure Allen was the killer. He said, what really bothers me about this case is that we were ready to charge Arthur Lee Allen, but he died before we could do that. Well, in 2014, Gary Stewart wrote a book, The Most Dangerous Animal of All, claiming his biological father was the elusive Zodiac Killer. Stewart had been abandoned in a stairwell soon after being born. As an adult, he learned his father was Earl Van Bess Jr., a book salesman whom Stewart said had disturbing fixations and rage issues. And he pointed out his father's appearance was a dead ringer for the police sketch circulated in 1969. And said that he found his father's initials, E.V. Best and Jr., in a Zodiac cipher sent to the San Francisco Examiner. San Francisco police commented they were investigating the claim, and an expert matched the handwriting of the Zodiac Killer's letters to Earl Van Best's signature on his marriage certificate. Hundreds of names have been linked to the case at one time or another, but a few individuals, all now dead, of course, warrant particular attention. One's Lewis Myers. Before his death in 2002, a friend said he had confessed to being the Zodiac Killer. He supposedly targeted couples after breaking up with his girlfriend. He had connections with several of the victims attending the same high school as David Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen and allegedly worked in the same restaurant as Darlene Farren. Furthermore, no Zodiac letters were received for a period between 71 and 73, and that was the same time Myers was stationed overseas with the military. Another suspect was named Lawrence Kane. He'd allegedly pestered Darlene Farren at work. He did have a history of sex offenses that ceased in 1969, fit the description of the killer, and could also be linked to the crime because an anagram of his surname can be found in the Zodiac Killer's cipher. In 1991, the Vallejo Police Department reopened the case and discovered that Kane's whereabouts matched places victims lived or murder scenes. Traumatic brain injury in a car crash in 62 had affected Kane's speech and gait, and it's conceivable the effects of his injury had gradually turned Kane into a murderer. He died in 2010 at the age of 86 in Nevada. Another suspect, Ross Sullivan, was hospitalized for bipolar disorder and schizophrenia several times. He also habitually wore boots whose soles were similar to footprints found at the Lake Berryessa murder scene and bore resemblance to the 1969 wanted poster sketch of the killer. Had short hair and glasses. It's not known whether Sutherland was ever interviewed by police. And another suspect with a connection to the Lake Bellarisa stabbings was Donnelly Bjork, a felon who was released from the Montana prison in 1968 after serving 11 years for killing a sheriff's deputy. Cecilia Shepherd and Brian Hartnell's attacker had told him he had just escaped from Colorado prison. Well, police are still hoping to finally solve this case with modern technology. 2018, Vallejo detectives sent two envelopes containing Zodiac letters to a lab in the hopes saliva from the envelope flap and stamps might contain the killer's DNA. Detective Terry Poyser said the lab could create a genetic profile based on the DNA. Then investigators might be able to track down the killer through genealogy websites. He just made the comment, it really comes down to the DNA. If you don't have that, you don't have anything. Well, to this point, been a lot of suspects, but no definitive determination of who the Zodiac killer actually was. Well, from the Zodiac, let's talk about the Oakland County child murderers of 1976. You know, like any parents, those living in Oakland County, Michigan, told their children to stay away from strangers. That's where stranger danger came from. These routine, everyday warnings were justified in the cruelest possible way. You know, the case of the Oakland County child killer, named after the Michigan county in which four terrifying kidnappings and murders occurred, panicked parents throughout the Midwest. And the details were somewhat baffling. Two male victims bore signs of sexual assault. The two female victims did not. Three were suffocated or strangled. One died of a shotgun blast to the head. All appeared to have been bathed at some point and were discovered neatly dressed. Well, 12-year-old Mark Stebbins and his older brother Mike regularly hung out together at the American Legion Hall at 9 Mile and Woodward, about a mile from their home in Ferndale, Michigan. And the Veterans Organization was a safe place for the boys to spend time. And one snowy Sunday in February 1976, they walked to the hall to play pool. After a while, Mark, described as a good student who liked to spend time alone, said he wanted to walk home to watch TV. And it was a path he had walked countless times before, both with his brother and by himself. But on this particular day, Mark didn't arrive home, and his mother, Ruth, called police in a panic. While Mark Stebbins' disappearance worried those who knew him, it wasn't the type of case that would normally get widespread media attention. Now, that changed 4 days later when on February 19th, an office worker in a nearby town of Southfield spotted his body, abandoned in a parking lot. Had rope burns on his wrist, but he wasn't bound. It appeared he'd been strangled or suffocated at least the day before. Ferndale Police Chief Donald Geary told reporters the boy's body had likely been kept in the trunk of a car before being ditched in the parking lot. Not only had he been scrubbed clean, but his fingernails had been scraped by the killer. As the police investigated, Mark's family mourned. Months passed by, and the tragic case slipped quietly from the headlines. On December 26, 1976, a motorist found the body of 12-year-old Jill Robinson in Troy, Michigan. She had left her Royal Oak home 4 days before after an argument with her mother over what to have for dinner. On the surface, it was rough to discern if Jill's death was related to Mark's. The little girl had died in a completely different manner, shotgun blast to the head rather than asphyxiation. It was very possible, police thought, that Jill had been killed with a shotgun when strangulation failed to kill her. But a few striking similarities led police to believe that there had to be a connection. Like Mark, Jill was described as a loner, and it appears she'd been kidnapped and held for days before being killed. As with Mark, she'd been fed and given water to drink while held captive. And her body, like Mark's, was dumped on a day it was at snowed, helping to obscure much-needed evidence. Well, the killer's pace quickened. The next victim disappeared just a week later, January 2nd, 1977, after leaving a party shop just 4 blocks from her home in nearby Berkeley, Michigan. 10-year-old Christian Mihalich bought a magazine and was walking along a busy thoroughfare in broad daylight when she vanished. Because Jill's body had been found so recently, Christine's disappearance was treated as far more urgency. Police helicopters swept the Area and officers canvassed the neighborhood looking for witnesses and clues and didn't find anything. A week after Christine vanished, police, of course, assumed the worst. And those fears were realized when snow fell on January 22, 1977, 19 days after Christine's disappearance. Mail carrier Jerry Wozny discovered Christine's body in a ditch along a dead-end road in Franklin, Michigan, another Oakland County town. He said, "I saw a hand. It scared the hell out of me." He said it appeared the snow had been tossed on top of the body to make her difficult to spot. Headlines the next day said slayings terrorized the county. And the Detroit News offered a reward of $10,000 to catch the killer. While that may not sound like a lot, in 1977, $10,000 was a fair amount of money. Less than 2 months later, that terror reached the King family. March 16, 1977, the 11-year-old Tim asked his sister Kathy for 30 cents so he could buy candy from a drugstore 3 blocks from home. Left his home in Birmingham, Michigan at about 8:15 in the evening and skateboarded to the Hunter Maple Pharmacy. Shop assistant Amy Walter saw him leave with his candy at about 8:30 through a rear door that led to a darkened parking lot. And Tim, whose parents had repeatedly warned him not to talk to strangers, never got home. Blue AMC Gremlin was seen parked in the lot where he was last seen. 2013, parts of a similar car were found buried in a field in Grand Blanc, Michigan. Tim King's body was found a week later. Like the other victims, he'd been kept alive much of that time he'd been missing. Officials believed he was suffocated within 6 hours of being found. While Tim was missing, his mother had written a letter to the Detroit News pleading for him to come home for some Kentucky Fried Chicken. That was his favorite meal. The autopsy of the body revealed the food he'd eaten just before he was killed. Fried chicken. Body was found in a ditch along a well-traveled dirt road in Livonia, Michigan, with his skateboard placed next to it. Like all the other victims, his body was carefully cleaned, aside from some samples of white dog hair. Location marked a change in pattern as Livonia fell in Wayne County rather than neighboring Oakland. Police and sheriff's deputies from both jurisdictions were dedicated to the case. Well, enough witnesses finally came forward for the police to create a sketch of a suspect. The face that emerged belonged to a white man with dark hair, a prominent nose, and thick lips. Bushy, mutton-chopped whiskers ran down his cheeks. An accompanying psychological profile told the community they were looking for somebody between 20 and 35 who was well-educated and worked in a white-collar job with enough flexibility to give him the freedom to carry out his crimes. Birmingham Police Chief Jerry Tobin said, "We believe he appears sane 99% of the time." And he also suggested the killer might actually be seeing a psychiatrist. You know, Tobin urged anybody in the medical legal profession to come forward with any information. And they began to suspect that the killer was being protected by somebody close to him, a relative or a friend. According to the police chief, no individual could have kept 4 children for varying lengths of time without somebody knowing about it. Well, it's probably because of that suspicion that family members of the victims were stonewalled by investigators. This was very frustrated at Tim's parents, and especially cooperative in humoring investigators' hunches early on. Detectives had believed that whoever was holding Tim hostage would react badly to his parents' emotional pleas, so they'd agreed to conceal their grief and keep their tone positive during news conferences. The Kings felt they'd received little cooperation from the authorities in return. A special task force was assigned to the case, but was disbanded in December 78, and they subsequently sued the county prosecutor's office, hoping to force it to release more evidence from the case. In 2012, office did release 6,000 pages of case documents, but the King's request that officials be forced to release more evidence was denied by the Michigan Supreme Court in 2017. Of course, they'd have had a different attitude if their kids had been kidnapped. Well, you know, little official information has meant that rumors have abounded over the identity of the Oakland County child killer. Few names were publicly tied to the case. Among the first was David Norberg, auto worker who drove a car that looked similar to the one described near Tim's abduction site. He'd been suspected of killing 2 girls in the late 70s, though he wasn't convicted. After he died in a car crash in 81, his wife found a small silver cross inscribed with the name Christine. She remembered the girl who had been the Oakland County child killer's 3rd victim and showed the cross to Christine's aunt, who said it was identical to the one Christine had worn at the Romeo Peach Festival shortly before her death. Police exhumed Norberger's body in 1999 to see if his DNA matched evidence from the case, but the results didn't tie him to the murders. Some investigators say there's no way that Norberg, a heavy drinker, would have been able to lure stranger danger or conscious children into his car, and he's been pretty much dismissed as a suspect. A convicted pedophile by the name of Christopher Bush was on the short list for the King family, and Erica McAvoy, Christine's half-sister. Son of a wealthy auto executive, Bush lived in the area at the time. He was questioned soon after Tim's death and admitted to investigators he was a pedophile. He also drove a car that looked similar to the one spotted at one of the abductions. Investigators wanted to keep him in jail, but Brooks Patterson, who headed the prosecutor's office during the killings, released him as part of a plea deal. November 1978, a few months later, Bush died by suicide at his home. A drawing of a screaming boy that resembled Mark Stebbins was found pinned to the wall. Another suspect was James Gunnels, a 51-year-old man connected to Christine's murder through DNA evidence. In 2012, investigators have revealed that a strand of hair found on Christine was a mitochondrial match for Gunnels, meaning it could have come from him or somebody on his mother's side of the family. Gunnels was no more than 16 at the time the crimes were committed. He'd been raped by Bush. 2012, Gunnels met with the King family and insisted he didn't know anything about the crimes. 2012, another tenuous DNA match produced a suspect named Arch Sloan, who was serving a life sentence for the rape of a 10-year-old boy in 1983. A hair found in his 1966 Pontiac Bonneville matched hair found on both Mark and Tim's crime scenes. Though the hair was not that of Sloan's, investigators believed it belonged to an acquaintance of his. DNA tests in 2013 also quashed allegations that the notorious serial killer John Wayne Gacy was the murderer. While the King and Mihalich family zeroed in on Bush as a suspect, Mark Stebbins' family filed a wrongful death lawsuit in 2007 against Theodore Lamborghini, a man who, like Sloan, was in prison for life on assault convictions. David Binkley, a lawyer representing the Stebbins family, said his clients didn't think Lamborghini acted alone and hoped the suit would help uncover more information. He pointed to Lamborghini's refusal to take a polygraph test, despite being offered a massively reduced prison sentence if he answered questions about the Oakland County child killings. Binkley said, "Wouldn't you deny being the Oakland County child killer?" Despite the family's suspicion, the suit was dismissed in 2008. But the judge did leave room for it to be refiled if more evidence should come to light. And Tim's father, Barry King, replayed time and again how he had talked to his son after the community learned of Christine's death. He said, "All my kids remember me telling Tim, if anybody tries to pick you up, drop everything and run and scream. And part of the tragedy to me is if once Tim got in the car, he knew what would happen. That's the worst part of it all." 2013, the King family produced a documentary titled Decades of Deceit, detailing what they perceived as the bungled investigation into their son's murder. As long as the mystery of the Oakland County child killer remains unsolved, the Kings and other victims' families remain haunted by the events of over 40 years ago. They're still searching for answers that have always been just out of reach. And the unfortunate thing is, when investigators look at the political ramifications and not justice, the case is never going to be solved. Well, until next week, this is Ken Huddle for the Ken Huddle Show, saying have a truly great weekend.